Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center. Meteorologist Adam Carroll, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, we did have a few, we had 3 inches of snow overnight at Park City Mountain Resort. So, you know, that's that little band of snow we talked about yesterday definitely was able to drop a few inches here in the mountains. Not much in and around Park City itself, but we also saw some pretty rapid clearing behind the clouds and the snow here last night. This morning, which led to a colder start than where we've been lately. Now, we'll continue to have some cold starts moving forward in the teens, but tomorrow right now looks to be our absolute best shot to see snow throughout the day. Of course, it'll still be scattered, but it very well could lead to accumulating snow in Park City, a couple inches, but more so in the mountains yet again. It will linger over the next few days, really through Saturday for the Wasatch Back in Park City, while maybe the Wasatch Front sees clearing and less in the way of opportunity to see moisture as an area of low pressure that is taking its sweet time exiting the region will continue to bring in wraparound moisture to places like Park City, Heber, and the Wasatch Back through Saturday. The temperatures will be 35 today, 33 tomorrow, 36 and 37 for the Friday-Saturday time frame. So we'll stay in that kind of more or less the mid-30s with mostly cloudy skies most of the time. And then we'll have a pretty nice Sunday, temperatures back into the 40s as well as Monday, but then we start getting back into a more unsettled stormier pattern heading into the midweek time frame where we'll also be cooler as well. So this kind of storm track continues. We're just not seeing a lot of snow. We need more of a blockbuster storm, and unfortunately, we don't have one of those coming anytime soon.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Adam.
You bet.
And with a look at the backcountry on the phone with us from Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. The snowpack got warm and wet last weekend with warm temperatures. It's pretty much refrozen solid now, so conditions aren't great. With a few inches on top of that, the avalanche danger is overall low. The only thing to watch out for is upper elevation ridge lines where the winds have drifted the snow and formed shallow soft laps. Other than that, avalanches are unlikely.
Okay, thanks. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City and Wasatch County Representative Mike Kohler. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dias with a preview of this week's City Council meeting. And finally, an update with Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bolo. First, the Steinville Basin Planning Commission last night voted unanimously to give a negative recommendation to the proposed Highland Flats project. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports the vote was against a general plan amendment and a rezone for the proposed 410 units.
The developers are asking to build on about 41 acres at the northeastern edge of the Highland Estates neighborhood, bounded on one side by Highland Drive and on the other side by Silver Creek Junction. Representing the applicants, attorney Wade Budge said they feel they are offering a compelling benefit, but given that the Snyderville planners were apparently headed to a negative recommendation, he asked the panel for a decision to send the project on to the Summit County Council. In their findings, the Planning Commission said that the project isn't consistent with the neighborhood plan for Highland Estates. Among the comments, Planning Commissioner Bruce Carmichael asked how the project could fit with the detached, single-family character of the neighborhood. He also said the traffic impacts wouldn't be directed just toward Highway 40, but also toward the Trailside area, Old Ranch Road, and Kimball Junction. The applicants have argued that they're meeting Provision 2.3 of the Snyderville Plan, saying that new density should only be allowed when it meets a compelling public benefit. However, Planning Commissioner Thomas Cook said that measured by the other nuances of 2.3, the project doesn't pass the threshold.
It's a moratorium on granting new entitlements until existing ones are significantly exhausted, and we know we're nowhere near that point. So when we look at what's the countervailing public interest, affordable housing, right? And so we have to be convinced in General Plan 2.3A that the affordable housing cannot be achieved any other way. And we just simply know that's not the case because we know there are other balls in the air right now. We have to be convinced General Plan 2.3B that what's being offered is not just an incidental benefit, but it is the primary benefit.
He added that the project isn't compatible with a wildlife corridor designation on the area. The Planning Commission also found that the zone change doesn't comply with the goals, objectives, and policies of the general plan. Chris Conaby said that paradoxically, the project is in the wrong spot, but it is trying to respond to a critical need and is proposed by an excellent developer.
I mean, I've worked with the Comina Group in my role as the inland port director for the state and also as the Point of the Mountain co-chair, and there isn't a finer developer in Salt Lake. It is the absolute worst case scenario as a planning commissioner to have such a great applicant in front of you with all the tools to move a project forward. They have capital, they're well capitalized, they understand what they're doing, their presentations are obviously great, they understand the code and what they're asking for. And so I feel like we have the right developer, but I could not think of a worse place to put the development.
In response, Wade Budge said the project is providing 324 units that are affordable or attainable, including units at 30% to 40% of area median income not available elsewhere in the county.
So on the concept of clustered, we've taken that to heart, and we believe what we've done by nestling this project in between interstate residential uses and then locating more residential use is consistent in the sense that the whole interchange is a clustered area for development. You got Silver Creek Village, you got the commercial on the other side by the Sinclair, you've got Highland Estates, and then you've got Highland Flat, which we're wanting to incorporate. We're being sensitive in terms of how we've proposed the buildings because it is a site that falls off towards the freeway. We're talking about two-story structures that would be similar in terms of mass and height to single family structures, particularly once you take into account the topography.
Attorney Wade Budge representing the Highland Flats project. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
And again, the Snydeville Basin Planning Commission voting unanimously to give a negative recommendation to the proposed Highland Flats projects. Well, as we've reported, more than 500 bills were passed during the 2021 legislative session, including a balanced budget. On the phone with a recap, I have State Representative Mike Kohler. He represents the Park City and Wasatch County District 54. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. So one of your bills, House Bill 390, the Urban Farming Amendments, passed the legislature waiting for Governor Cox's signature. What will this do for your constituents?
You know, I think that's going to work all over the state, but what urban farming does is give those people who have less than 5 acres, which is required for normal greenbelt tax status, if they're intense farmers, in other words, they want to do a garden or they want to do something that's actively farming, to actually get the lower tax status to keep it open. Big problem we have in our area, and I'm sure Park City and throughout the state really, is that keeping a small parcel of either in a lawn or even in pastures or something next to homes are being sold off because the taxes are too high. So if somebody's willing to do some work, they can keep it open.
Okay. And this would go also for the growing of pot, of marijuana?
That's an interesting question. I haven't been asked. All the law says is a marketable crop. So my guess is that's quite marketable.
Okay. You were also the floor sponsor of Senator Winterton's film economic incentives bill that is almost at $10 million of tax credits. Is that enough to get production back to the state?
You know, it's not as much as our states the states that we're competing with have. In fact, it's a lot less. But what the Film Commission has tried to do over the past several years is keep roughly $10 million in the revolving pot to help. Now, a lot of focus at the time of the legislation and throughout the last year has been the loss of the movie that was being filmed over there, Yellowstone. And it was taken away for roughly about that much. Apparently, now it's hard to say whether that was the killer or not. I mean, people move for various reasons, and I'm sure there was a lot of other factors. But that said, the Film Commission feels they have enough to at least do some leveraging and some incentivizing to get movies coming here with that much. Again, it's much less than most other states around us, but it's something that we tried to get to 10, and I think it'll help them.
All right. And now we also, some of these COVID-related bills, the so-called endgame bill, which would end the mask mandate April 10th. Summit County, of course, one of the first areas to have a mask mandate. Wasatch County didn't start enforcing masks until the statewide mandate. Even then, it was met with some reluctance. Wasatch County moving into the moderate phase last week. Do you think it's a smart idea to remove a mandate right as case numbers are starting to decrease?
Well, I think we're moving in the right direction, and my personal perception of this was it was a little incentive to the governor and to the Department of Health to try and open versus the default of not opening. Now, it doesn't bar anybody from wearing a mask. If you have an issue with it, whether it's personal feelings about it, a health condition, you should wear a mask if that's what makes you feel good about it. But we have school districts, particularly the Salt Lake School District, who is still, with everybody else really opening around them and having been open, they're staying shut for reasons that are similar to the others. It's interesting because some districts are using the same rule to open versus them staying closed. So we just wanted to incentivize opening up and kind of put a limitation on it unless somebody actively takes a role. And that's the health department. It might be the governor based on what's happening, the time statistically and with the virus spreading or not spreading, to open up rather than just allow it to passively stay in place. Lots of people want to get kids back to school. Statistically, the virus doesn't affect them. And there's a lot of talk and a lot of information about kids that are having high stress for it. Either suicides are up. I mean, that's the extreme part. But loss of education opportunities and others. So we wanted to incentivize opening up, unless, again, one of these departments, rather than just passively letting these rules continue, puts something on the table that says, no, we need to stay shut, and this is why.
All right. The so-called executive powers bill, the checks and balances on the governor and state and local health departments, both of these bills give local municipalities more power than they currently have. Do you feel like the legislature did a good job of allowing local authorities to keep power?
I like the general direction of the bill. Local control is always better, in my opinion. Local government's better. And so, yeah, I think it's going in the right direction. Again, I think we've come, at least with the pandemic, to a point where it's kind of being, the rules are being passively left in place because nobody's willing to make a move that maybe puts somebody in jeopardy of either litigation or making an error. So I think both these bills just put a little bit more pressure on those making the decisions to put something on the table that justifies it.
Yeah. You know, and we often hear from Utah Republicans about the need for local control, and yet then we have issues like the ban on, you know, plastic bags, and it's like, well, no, you can't have that local control. So, I mean, at what point do we get local control or not?
Well, obviously, it's incident-related. I remember when Park City went through that, and we fought for another one a couple of times this time, one relating to the local auxiliary units for homes, where we think that, and as does your leadership in Park City, think that that should be a local control. But, yeah, we're consistency is not one of the states or the federal government's traits, I would say, when it comes to that. I mean, we try to push that way, and most Republicans like it that way, but oftentimes they're not afraid to take control either. So I can't argue that one at all.
All right. Well, then let's talk a little bit about that bill that you mentioned, House Bill 82, the single-family housing modifications would allow in-law units inside of homes. And there were initial concerns about the short-term rentals, but a substitution of the bill apparently addressed that. It did pass the House and the Senate and is waiting for the governor to sign off. Of course, you know, affordable housing, an issue everywhere, certainly one of the big concerns in the Heber Valley and Summit County area. It seems like an easy fix to the problem, but you voted against the bill?
I did, mainly because of the local control aspect of it. Now, that said, just blanket letting everybody put a caretaker or a mother-in-law or whatever you call them, apartment in homes, when you're looking at it from an affordable housing standpoint, may seem like a simple fix. But it has, in my opinion, the ability to change a lot of things, that being such as some communities could be doubled overnight type thing. I mean, they could, because there's really very little restriction to them when it started, especially. It's a little bit more in the end based on who uses it. Has to be a primary resident living in one part of it. So we kind of brought the, shall we say, brought the window a little bit further closed on what and when it can be used. But I just want to make sure that the locals can have something to say about it to make sure they can maintain communities, because that, I believe, is something that a lot of people in both of our communities bought homes to do, and they didn't buy it with the anticipation of having double the population, double the parking, et cetera. And so I just think it has to be thought out and maybe a little bit more management by local government.
Yeah, but the fact that it's passed, I mean, are you confident that it's going to do what it's supposed to do?
Well, you never know. Obviously, when the language that we vote on is what it is, and then the government locally and state start writing the rules and how it'll apply, I expect this one's going to have a lasting impact over time, but probably not in the immediate future, giving us an opportunity to see how it develops and maybe make some adjustments to it later. But it'll come down to the local cities and towns and counties to make those recommendations as they see problems arise from it. Maybe it's going to move in smoothly and nobody will care, but we'll see how it goes.
All right. Then there is Senate Bill 164, the Utah Housing Affordability Amendments. That bill would require cities to have a plan to encourage the building of more moderately priced homes. It sets up $500,000 in grants to encourage more affordable housing in Utah and another $300,000 towards mediation programs for landlords and tenants. Sounds like that could go in a week. But you voted in favor of the bill. What do you feel like it will offer to your constituents?
Well, as you talked about the original problem, affordable housing is an issue, and this is an incentive bill that allows, again, local control over and to incentivize or to give credits, however it works locally, to do it. Because somehow we need more affordable housing. I get that. But I'd rather do it this way with the carrot than another way where we force something on them. Now, there are affordable housing rules in the state right now, but the way they're applied in counties versus cities and across their adjoining areas is kind of disjointed and not really well coordinated. So hopefully this will help that as well, because it ought to be a coordinated effort.
Now, the bill's sponsor, Senator Jacob Anderegg, said that, quote, the cost of living has not kept up with inflation. Certainly isn't another solution to affordable housing, though, raising the minimum wage?
You know, that's an argument I guess you could make. My personal opinion, I'm not for the the wage increase for a couple of reasons. And even yesterday there was some news coming out of D.C. that it would raise wages on certain people, you know, up to, and they gave millions, but about a third of the amount that it raised, a third of that number would represents jobs that would be lost because they couldn't afford, the businesses couldn't afford to pay them. I am concerned. My personal philosophy is that $15 an hour or a minimum wage job that's less than that was never meant to be a livable wage. That's a starting wage. It's something that people can get in, usually younger people, younger families, whatever, to use to get to a higher and better wage based on experience and education. And if we're going to suggest that even $15 is a livable wage, it isn't. I mean, and so I think it's a misnomer, and I hate to see people think that just raising the minimum wage is the solution to everything, because, again, I don't think it's livable. I think it's a starting point, and even in the lower ones, and if you do that, you're going to take some of these lower jobs that, again, young people and kids that are starting out in the workforce, they'll be gone. They'll either automate them or they'll go because they can't produce enough income and value to keep them.
Something we haven't heard a lot about, House Bill 136, a bill that actually makes it harder to get a citizen initiative or referendum on the general ballot. Why is this a good thing? Because it seems like over the years, the legislature has only made it increasingly difficult to do so. You know, we've seen bills require signature gathers, need to collect more signatures in less time. I mean, given the supermajority of Republican rule in the state, you know, how do people enact laws when they don't feel like the legislature is listening to them?
Well, I think what this does, and if in my opinion, how the rule went, it really won't change, at least the way I read it, won't change a lot for people who are working on an initiative on a grassroots level. What we've seen over the last several years is the growth of an industry of people getting signatures by paying for it, whether you're doing an initiative or whether you're running for office. And so what this bill does is, and it's been a while since I read it, so I'm paraphrase a little bit, but if it's the one I'm thinking of, it will require somebody who's being paid to get the signatures to wear something that indicates they are, so that there's no misunderstanding about that this is somehow I'm your neighbor doing it. And they have to provide information at the spot that tells people what they're signing so they have a chance to read it versus just running through and trying to get as many signatures as they can and realizing many of them may not stay because they're not valid or that whether people know what they're signing or not doesn't matter. This just requires a couple of checkpoints where we think at least I think that those signing it will have a little better understanding of what they're doing and who's pushing it. Now, if I'm going to start an initiative, I don't have to have that restriction. I can do that myself. It's just putting a little bit more control on those who are doing it for profit to be a little more ethical.
Yeah, and then also about House Bill 197, which would block voters from changing party affiliation for 3 months before a primary election. Do you think that this really would have changed the outcome of our governor's primary race here?
It's hard to say. Utah has an interesting dynamic when it comes to elections because of the fact that the majority of Republicans usually, well, the governor's race was perfectly a perfect example of it, where the Republicans had multiple people running for governor, and there were some Democrats, but it was unlikely to win, have a Democrat win, so many people switched over. Now, you heard rumors about in the Burgess-Owens-McAdams race that people were voting for one of the Republicans. That would be the people that switched over from the other, from Democrat or whatever, were voting for a less strong candidate to run against McAdams. I mean, that's arguable whether they can produce that much unity to make a difference. But it is thought that primaries are for the party, those who are part of that party, to select their strongest candidate and one that carries for them and holds their views, and to have an easy way. Now, you can still do it. It's just more difficult. But to have an easy way to just jump in back and forth across the fence was thought to be maybe a little bit better, so that when we do get to the final election, the person that was picked, whether it be Republican or Democrat or whatever, was actually a party person more than a hybrid, if you will.
Okay. Hey, anything else you'd like to mention, Mike?
No, unless you have questions. It was an interesting session with COVID, and we were able to hold live session testing a couple of times a week, and a lot of predictions that it wouldn't last, and many states haven't tried it, but thankfully it all worked well, and hopefully next year we can get back into it where lobbyists and regular people can be at the Capitol all the time, where we'll get the energy back that it used to have.
You want more lobbyists?
Well, they're a part of the game. For me, it's an educational thing. When I was a lobbyist, my point was educating. It wasn't necessarily a negative thing. So sometimes you need to know something about it. That works. But not only were they not there, but a lot of individuals that came up as normal citizens couldn't be there this time. And the energy to having them on the Hill during the session, I think, is good.
Interesting. Okay. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for your time.
Have a good day.
That's State Representative Mike Kohler representing District 54. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Council meets Thursday, starting a work session at 5:15 with a special events update. On the phone with a preview of the agenda, I have Park City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Well, thank you. So, special events. So, we're at a point in the pandemic that we can start discussing opening up special events this year?
Well, you know, believe it or not, it takes months to prepare for, you know, the various special events that we have as a community. Particularly the large ones are very complex and take all sorts of planning with stakeholders, event applicants, and various city departments to make sure that they operate successfully. So, you know, staff wanted to come in and share the calendar for the year. We've been working proactively with the Summit County Health Department, Chamber of Commerce, Summit County, and event applicants. And, you know, more or less, the story is we're hoping to have an events calendar very similar to previous years, but obviously under the heavy guidance of the Summit County Health Departments and all of the COVID regulations that would need to be in place.
So what are the going to be the parameters of special events? Already, you know, Back Alley Bash isn't going to happen, Savor the Summit. I mean, are we going to allow 4th of July, which is probably the granddaddy of them all?
Well, you know, I think the expectation is that there's some optimism on the horizon. And we've been working very closely with the health department. And they've been looking favorably that, you know, perhaps later this summer, we will be able to reinvigorate the special events aspect of our community and do so safely. And we need to start planning for that now. You know, believe it or not, when we're talking about hiring and law enforcement and setup and breakdown. But fortunately, you know, the event applicants have been very sensitive to the fact that we're going to need to be adaptable and flexible and perhaps make changes on the fly, or even a week or two right before a large event, make a drastic change if for some reason we're not able to operate them safely.
Now, for special events, the city's been spending more than $500,000 a year for transit, traffic management, residential mitigation, all of that stuff. Now that we're kind of like starting afresh, is this the time to start reining those expenses in?
Well, perhaps. I think that would ultimately be a decision by the city council and mayor. We've always looked upon that investment. There's a large return for our community, for our cultural economy, and for our actual economy in terms of our stores and shops and bars and restaurants and retail establishments and lodging establishments. So for us, that $500,000 is a policy question, but that's always been an investment that we think there's a great return on for our economy and our community.
All right. The council also being asked to approve about a $220,000 demolition contract for the Arts and Culture District. I think later than, I was thinking this was going to happen last November. But once that's approved, then what?
Well, so the plan is sort of irrespective of what happens with the Arts and Culture and Housing District long term. There are some considerable land, a kind of physical land use work that needs to be done and undertaken in terms of demolishing the buildings, site suitability, preparation. So the plan is to take down the vast majority of the buildings this spring. We will be keeping the Maverick in place temporarily as a construction headquarters and a sort of exhibition venue to look at the plans for the Arts and Culture District and the housing that will be sited in this location. So initially, it will be demolition of the structures, but one will remain.
Okay, and that's probably actually the most difficult, no, given the gas tanks and stuff underneath it?
Well, that's a fine question. Those were remediated this summer, so we had a successful remediation undertaken this summer in coordination with the environmental agencies in our state. And so that work's already been done.
Ah, okay. Let's see. Another budget adjustment is planned. Based on what I saw, December looked good, that we know. And what do we know about January with Sundance not here?
Well, that's the golden question. In our mind, that's the big unknown right now. And I think we are biting our fingernails to try and determine how that will impact, you know, the overall winter economy. We've been very fortunate thus far, and you know, a lot of work went into that fortune in terms of standing up businesses, providing PPEs, ensuring that the nonprofits had resources to support our employees, you know, the whole ecosystem. A lot of work went into this success. But you know, December was down a little, about 10%. We consider that good fortune. And with the optimism and vaccinations on the horizon and people's confidence gaining in travel, our hope is that the rest of the winter is even stronger. But clearly, that, you know, that week or week and a half around Sundance is the unknown. We should have that information in about 2.5 to 3 weeks.
Okay, so what are we going to do with the budget adjustment then?
Well, so this budget adjustment is actually sort of unrelated to the ongoing sales tax that we're collecting throughout the year. This budget has already been planned as part of the FY21 budget process, which begins on July 1st each year. So this budget adjustment is to order new golf carts, believe it or not. We had the best year ever, most successful year at our municipal golf course. And the utilization of the carts, mainly due to COVID, accelerated our replacement schedule. So we have a roughly $350,000 request to order a new golf cart fleet that was not in the initial budget during July. And then further, we have a reorganization in our public works and our golf department as a result of longtime employee, probably many residents are familiar with the name of Clint Daly. Clint used to run our streets department, our golf maintenance department, and our building department. And due to his retirement after about 33 years, we had to reorganize those departments or hire a new manager. And so we opted for a reorganization. And that will entail having perhaps a more traditional public works department. And then our golf manager, Vaughn Robinson, will now be responsible for not only the operations and the management of the course, but also all the maintenance, the grass clippings, the fertilizer, everything that goes into the maintenance of the course.
All right. Well, speaking of reorganizations, the council will get an update from the housing department. And I'm like, where have I been? When did we get a housing department?
We've had one for several years. It's been a division within our community development department. And this was, proactively enacted right around the time that housing became a critical community priority. We have three employees in the housing department, Jason Glidden, Rhoda Stauffer, and Elise Matz. And so for several years now, we've had a housing department. And, they have a three-pronged strategy. So every day they're working on policies, procedures, resolutions, our land management code, state legislation, anything we can do to make it easier to deliver affordable and community housing. They're also working on development. The city is proactively delivering, constructing affordable housing. And then the third piece that we've been focusing on more lately is public-private partnerships. We think there is a great opportunity to tap into the expertise of the private sector, repurpose municipal land that's either underutilized or not used, and potentially have a private developer construct, build, and deliver housing on municipal land.
So why would we do that? Because then where's the profit? I mean, if the city's not doing it, then you lose the entire link, because the thought was if the city builds it, then the city gets the rents and the sale prices and to continue building more. So have you just put a roadblock up to that or no?
No, quite the contrary. So sort of like any transaction, the devil's in the details. But our hope is to collaborate with the private developer that will generate profit or rely upon a federal housing program to receive tax credits or tax incentives to deliver. For example, we've been talking about the Homestake parking lot. We could deliver 100 units of housing as that parking lot that the city wouldn't have to be the developer. An incredible amount of work, as goes into the land use design, architecture, site suitability, and then actual construction. Tens of thousands of hours. And if we could have that resource provided by the private sector collaborate on the financial model to deliver housing, we think we could have several plates spinning in the air as opposed to one or two, which will bring ultimately more housing to the table sooner.
So this PPP task force, the public-private partnership, it's interesting to see who chose who's on that. I mean, I recognize some of the names, big developers, Rory Murphy, Tony Tyler, Bill Coleman.
The mayor and council solicited input. The staff was also familiar with, in the community development department, working with architecture firms, developers, contractors. That's a big group, and you're right. We tried to have developers in there with a big D that are representing big companies and big development, and then small developers, little d, more of the single family home or an architect in town. And then also we relied on some nonprofits, Mountainlands Community Housing, some other financial experts, Habitat for Humanity, to make hopefully a diverse group of individuals that could provide input and guidance and expertise to the city as we move forward on this third endeavor. We've got the regulatory and the policy piece underway. We're also developing housing on our own, but we need to invest more in this public-private partnership idea.
So what the city has that the developers don't is the raw land.
That's correct, and you just have to look around at what's happened in the last 10 months and realize how precious a resource that is. And if that could be used as a catalyst, that's the indication that we've had thus far from City Council, that that's a perfect way for potentially a municipality to incentivize the private sector to help us with the housing crisis that's underway.
And one of the, on the to-do list for the housing department was to develop a list of options for Woodside Park Phase 2. It looks like one of those options would be to sell off portions of the parcel. Why would you do this?
Well, I think ultimately there are several parcels of land there that the city has put together over the better part of a decade. And they have different values associated with them depending on their location. I think the highest value pieces are the pieces of land closer to the resort, quite frankly. And they're also more difficult to develop because of their topography. So there are alternatives to cut off an appendage of the properties that we've gathered that are the most valuable, to perhaps sell those and then return that profit into the community housing fund to deliver more units at a lower cost in another location in the city.
So does this mean that the senior center stays put? I mean, has the city acquiesced that the 99-year lease is intact?
I think right now we're more or less in status quo. The city's posture, with the seniors is that they're an incredibly important stakeholder and never envisioned having to evict or forcibly remove the facility or anything like that. We thought we had a mutually agreeable solution, which was to build the seniors a brand new senior center in City Park and then be able to repurpose the Woodside property to deliver more kind of critical, affordable housing. And we thought it was a win-win. The seniors ultimately decided that, at least for now, that they weren't interested in moving. And so, for us, it was never about a lease or about an eviction. We thought we had a win-win on our hands. And so, obviously, that's unfortunate, but the seniors are an important stakeholder, and we're committed to working with them moving forward.
All right. Hey, Matt, I'm out of time. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Appreciate it.
That's Park City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. We are approaching the year mark when Summit County was pulled into the COVID-19 pandemic, reporting the first case of community spread in the state. Here with a look back, I have Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bullo. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what's the biggest takeaway looking back over the last year?
I think we did things right. As we look back and look at the way that we acted in Summit County and the fact that we put in place some mitigative measures pretty early, I think we've come a long ways. We've learned lessons. We still do have some certainly challenges ahead of us as far as getting the vaccines out.
So anything you could have changed knowing what you know now?
That's a really good question. We've been batting that around internally. And I can honestly say that given the information that we had at the time, I think we made the right moves. And I think that can be demonstrated by the fact that the governor and some other communities across the state took similar actions as we did early on. And if we look at mortality rates, case fatality rate, and certainly we can't take all of the credit for that. We have a healthy population. We've got, a relatively well-to-do population, a great medical system. But our case fatality rate is extraordinarily low in Summit County. To put it in perspective, every state surrounding Utah has case fatality rates over 100 per 100,000. The lowest in the country is 31 per 100,000. That's Hawaii. Utah's at 62. And Summit County is at 24. And so I think that speaks well to what we did. And again, we can't take credit for that incredibly low case fatality rate. But I think certainly it suggests that some of the actions that were taken have helped save lives.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about just, as we saw this come on, health officials still reluctant to share any information about businesses that have defied health orders or causing actual spreading events. But with the case of the Ground Zero business that was targeted for the first case of community spread, it was broadcast everywhere. Was that just a mistake?
No, actually it wasn't. We made the decision because of the type of event that occurred. We ended up, I had to close the bar. And at the time, the state, because of the number of individuals that had been in contact with the positive case, the state basically just said, this is the direction we need to go. And so we made the decision relatively early on to disclose that business, in large part to help with contact tracing. There was no way for us to do the case investigation and contact tracing, given that about 500 people, roughly, had been in contact with the positive case. So we released that name, that business name, in an effort to have people reach out to us and say, I was there. And in fact, that was very successful. We had a lot of people contact us, and it allowed us to move down that chain of investigation and help mitigate the spread.
Interesting, though, because the employee hadn't been there for 10 days.
That's true, but we knew that there had been, 10 days is basically the incubation period. And so we knew there'd been this large number of people in contact, and we expected to be right on the threshold of a major event of spread. And so it allowed us, by releasing that name, it allowed us to get a jump on that investigation.
All right. Let's move on. We're hearing so much about the variants and the uncertainty of double infections. What's the latest that we know here?
Well, we have had the UK variant in Summit County, and there's been several cases in the state. Nationwide, about 10% of new cases now are variants, and that is certainly very concerning. The data are not yet real clear about whether or not the current vaccines completely protect from the variants, and there's some evidence to suggest that they're not real protective of the variant from Brazil and South Africa. So brings an important point forward. We still need to be careful. It is true that cases are dropping. We're getting people vaccinated. We've got a fair number of people, estimated to be somewhere in the ballpark of 20% of the population has already had COVID. But we don't know really what these variants are going to do moving forward.
Let's move on to vaccines. When do you expect Summit County to be fully vaccinated?
Well, I was just running some data this morning, and they do not include the clinics that were held yesterday. But the numbers are really impressive. Right now, in individuals 70 plus, over 88% have had at least their first dose. Individuals 65 to 69, 80% have had their first dose. And let me pause there. Those are the two groups that we know have the highest risk. And so we're very much approaching a level of significant protection in those two groups. As you know, we've extended the vaccines to other age groups, but that was only a week ago. So in a week, individuals 50 to 64, 35% have been vaccinated. And if you look at the entire population over 18 in Summit County, 36% of them have been vaccinated. So the answer, I think, is that we're almost there on the highest risk populations, those over the age of 65. But we've got quite a long ways to go in individuals younger than that.
Yeah. So any feel for how many county residents won't participate in the vaccination program? I mean, we've still got 12% of that 70 plus, and they've had plenty of time to do that.
Well, so I think we're above 90 now, 90% and 70 plus, counting yesterday's clinic. I anticipate we're going to end up somewhere around 95%. The big question for us is, are those individuals that chose not to be vaccinated, or have we missed people? It could also be the fact that those people aren't in the county. You know, they're counted as residents, but they may not be here. And so they haven't come in to be vaccinated, and perhaps they've been vaccinated somewhere else and we're not capturing them in the system. So we think the uptake in these high-risk populations is really high. One thing that we're seeing in Summit County compared to other counties is that we're filling our appointments really fast. And I was on a call yesterday with health officers. Several health districts across the state are saying they can't fill their appointments. And so I think we're going to do well in the county. I think we'll have certain pockets that may not have as much uptake. And part of our plan is to, at some point in time, expand, perhaps with pop-up clinics or mobile clinics. We're going to try to really focus in and remove barriers and make sure that we're making this easy, that people can get the vaccine without a bunch of barriers. And more and more, that's what we're focusing on.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the guidelines for the timing of vaccinating someone who has had the virus. I mean, should people have been recovered for a minimum amount of time before they get the vaccination?
CDC, the recommendation is 90 days. And so that's one of our qualifying conditions. We're not vaccinating individuals who have had COVID, a confirmed case of COVID, in the past 90 days.
Yeah. And what do we know about those who are displaying reactions to the vaccines and those who are not? Apparently younger people are getting harder hit. Do we know why?
Well, yeah, it actually makes sense. And first of all, keep in mind, I'm not an infectious disease or immunologist, disease expert. So I'm just relaying what I've read. Generally, younger people have more robust immune systems. And we know this is the case with influenza, for example. There's even a different vaccine for older adults who have influenza or influenza vaccine. It's more powerful because they tend to not have a stronger reaction. So what we're seeing is that you're right, it is younger people. The mean age of people that have had a reaction nationwide, out of about 13 million doses, CDC just released a study recently, the mean age is 42. Most of them are women. Almost all of the reactions are very minor. In fact, any reaction is actually very rare, somewhere in the ballpark of 0.05% have had a reaction. So it's a very safe vaccine. That number, by the way, is very similar to the influenza vaccine.
Yeah, and I guess I just know of one person who had COVID, had the vaccine, and has had, I mean, she feels like she's had COVID again. I mean, it's been 5 days of severity. I mean, you know, the chills and the night sweats have been extreme. The body aches and headaches have been as bad as the whole COVID course. Is that just a bad reaction to it? I mean, she's kind of wondering if she can skip the second dose.
Well, so to that point, the data suggests very strongly that you should not skip the second dose. But those studies are ongoing. And in fact, there's some conversation now that individuals who have had COVID, in essence, the first dose of a vaccine serves as a booster. And so those studies are ongoing, but we've got to be really careful because the data just are not in yet. But of course, that is, you know, it's an individual's decision on whether or not to skip that second dose. I will tell you that, and this is purely anecdotal, but that's a pretty unusual reaction for a first dose of the Moderna vaccine, which is what we're giving. By far, the majority of people don't have any reaction to that first dose, maybe a little bit of a sore arm. It's the second dose where you see a little higher frequency of you know, aches and pains and chills. And but generally, they don't last as long as what you're describing. So I certainly can't speak to that case, but I would say that's an unusual reaction.
Okay, I've got a couple more questions, but only a couple of minutes here. The Latinx community and vaccines, do we see any social inequity happening? I mean, are they getting the vaccines too?
They are getting the vaccines. To your social inequity question, I'm certain it's there. You know, that's just that, unfortunately, the nature of that issue. It's they're generally a harder population to reach, and there is some suspicion, not just about the vaccine, but about the entities that provide the vaccine. We're lucky here. There's been a lot of outreach. People's Health Clinic has held clinics for individuals that meet the guidelines who are of the Latinx community. They've provided vaccines right in their clinic for those individuals, their current patients. They've been doing outreach. They were at Aspen Via last week doing sign up. We've got partners here across the board. I know that Lynnwood Peak is doing a lot of work, Park City Community Foundation, and many, many others, too many to name. But that's going to be one of our targets, one of our focuses. And as you know, in Utah, we've been told to get the vaccines in arms within 7 days. That's a really good thing. Unfortunately, there are populations that are going to take longer than that. And so, you know, we're having the conversation now. Is it about speed or is it about reaching disparately affected populations? Right now, we're trying to balance both. But at some point in time, I think we need to hone in and really put those efforts and focus those efforts to reaching those populations that may not have as high an uptake.
The mask mandate ends one day before Deer Valley and now Park City Mountain Resort closed. If that's the case, people want to know, can we just fully load the lifts already?
No. We still have to, in fact, you know, social distancing, all of those things that are in place are still in place.
And will you be extending?
And, you know,
will you be extending the mask
mandate?
Well,
we're having conversations internally right now. The important point to remember is that even if we were to extend a mask order in Summit County, in that bill, in House Bill 294, there are specific criteria that once those criteria are met, local mask orders are not allowed. And those criteria include delivery of vaccine. And so after April 10th, we estimate that it's only maybe a maximum of about a month that we could implement a local mask order. So we're having those conversations internally. There are some other options. You know, businesses can still require masks. We can provide masks to workers to help to protect them. And of course, individuals can still wear masks. You know, so.
Looks like we've lost him. But Rich Boloth, hey, thanks for your time. Been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.